So this evening we begin a new chapter, the fifth chapter in the Yoga of Divine Works, the ascent of the sacrifice, the works of knowledge, the psychic being. Now, when Sri Aurobindo was originally composing the Arya, this chapter and the following chapter are both kind of seated in that initial view, but he so rewrote that, obviously expanded it many, many pages, that it's hard to discern here and there a few phrases that carried over into these new chapters. They're completely a reconstruction. If you go back to the Arya, though, and you read that chapter, you'll find some germinal ideas in that that are worth savoring. So I do encourage you to go back. You can find that online at archive.org. You can download the first volume of the Arya from 1914 to 1915. Good luck on your search. Sri Aurobindo has been working the larger themes of the Gita and bringing them into his view of what an integral life would be, so that there is continuity between the grandest of the Vedantic synthesis and how he would posit a yoga going forward. He has just predicated in the immediate pages ahead of this the emergence of the psyche, which is the secret inmost soul within us, that spark of the supreme divine that is within all beings, which should work along with the divine presence, which empowers that psychic spark to achieve great things in the life and the circuits of the cosmos and its development. So the individual, again, is central to working out what is a universal possibility. Both universe and individual come to their consummation only when the soul is found. There is an individual soul which we must find. There is a cosmic soul which must also find its expression in a more vaster realm of being. So tonight we enter this where specific attention is paid to the emergence of the soul from within. How is it that we find it? How do we put it in direct commerce with the divine energies flowing down from above? What is the practicality of this? So we begin with knowledge, but knowledge of the soul. So chapter 5. The Ascent of the Sacrifice, 1. The Works of Knowledge, the Psychic Being. This, then, is in its foundations, the integral knowledge of the Supreme and Infinite, to whom we offer our sacrifice. And this, the nature of the sacrifice itself in its triple character. A sacrifice of works, a sacrifice of love and adoration, a sacrifice of knowledge. For even when we speak of the sacrifice of works by itself, we do not mean the offering only of our outward acts, but of all that is active and dynamic in us. Our internal movements, no less than our external doings, are to be consecrated on the one altar. So he brings us to immediately embrace the triple path of the Gita, the Trimarga. Path of knowledge, path of works, path of love, all conjoined. You begin with what is your most comfortable base. Here, Sri Aurobindo begins with the idea that works alone unify knowledge and love. So the Trimarga of the Gita is already with us But something else that the Gita insists upon, that the sacrifice has an internal dimension. It isn't the outward offering of an act. The Vedic sacrifice, or a puja, where we offer flowers and incense and vegetal offerings to the divine. No, this is the composition of an inner offering, a recognition of the value of our experience, and a turning of it away from egoistic consumption, and a placing of that fine fruit of our lives into the hands of the Supreme. So there's an inner dimension which has to seize the outer, and that is Sri Aurobindo's point. The inner heart of all work that is made into a sacrifice is a labor of self-discipline and self-perfection by which we can hope to become conscious and luminous with a light from above poured into all our movements of mind, heart, will, sense, life, and body. It's not a mere emotional state. It requires self-discipline, a tapasya, self-perfection, siddhi. So we have to practice hard and really reach the realization into the very ground of our being for this to become successful. An increasing light of divine consciousness will make us close in soul and one by identity in our inmost being and spiritual substance with the master of the world sacrifice, the supreme object of existence proposed by the ancient Vedanta. But also, it will tend to make us one in our becoming by resemblance to the divine in our nature, the mystic sense of the symbol of sacrifice in the sealed speech of the seers of the Veda. So, close in soul and one by identity, sayujya. Make us one in our becoming by resemblance, sarupya, putting on the same form as the divine. And so, again, one never finds an occasion where it is not meet to mention that image of Nataraj, where he is undertaking all of the action of the world, maintaining the universe in its stupendous variety. All of it, though, occurs within the scope of his own conscious being. And he prods you into growth, and he brings you to him. So he makes you work, he makes you aspire, he makes you his devotee. But also, he makes you know. Note that his eyes are always closed, because he is concentrated on the inner realities, even while he undertakes all the outward work. So, just as the Supreme, as represented in the figure of Nataraj, can be transcendent and universal and individual, so must we. That's why he says, come, come to me. Come to me, and through the act of surrender, through the act of self-offering, I will make you like me. I will make you akin to me. Your form will more and more reflect my form. My light and power will vivify you, ennoble you. You will be my representative upon earth. But if this is to be the character of the rapid evolution, from a mental to a spiritual being contemplated by the integral yoga, a question arises full of many perplexities, but of great dynamic importance. How are we to deal with life and works as they now are, with the activities proper to our still unchanged human nature? An ascension towards a greater consciousness An occupation of our mind, life, and body by its powers has been accepted as the outstanding object of the yoga. But still, life here, not some other life elsewhere, is proposed as the immediate field of the action of the spirit. A transformation, not an annihilation of our instrumental being and nature. So transformation, to Sri Aurobindo, does not mean simply a change in form. That's what the word literally means, to change form. But he means to reverse the order of being and for us to be consciously founded in the truth of existence, in Sat, expressing powerfully the truth of that existence through Chit, and reaching Ananda as a result. And we have all the stadia, all the ladder of existence to climb from brute matter all the way through the supermind to achieve that. So it is a long goal. It is a cosmic growth that is demanded. But at no point do we annihilate the nature. At no point does the integral yogin say, enough of this world, I renounce it. You may step back from it to secure the inner liberation, but you then re-emerge into life to divinize it. What then becomes of the present activities of our being, activities of the mind turned towards knowledge and the expression of knowledge, activities of our emotional and sensational parts, activities of outward conduct, creation, production, the will turned towards mastery over men, things, life, the world, the forces of nature? Are they to be abandoned and to be replaced by some other way of living in which a spiritualized consciousness can find its true expression and figure? Are they to be maintained as they are in their outward appearance, but transformed by an inner spirit in the act, or enlarged in scope and liberated into new forms by a reversal of consciousness, such as was seen on earth when man took up the vital activities of the animal to mentalize and extend and transfigure them by the infusion of reason, thinking will, refined emotion, and organized intelligence? Or is there to be an abandonment in part, a preservation only of such of them as can bear a spiritual change, and for the rest, the creation of a new life expressive in its form, no less than in its inspiration and motive force, of the unity, wideness, peace, joy, and harmony of the liberated spirit? It is this problem most of all that has exercised the minds of those who have tried to trace the paths that lead from the human to the divine in the long journey of the yoga. So is it renunciation, or is it self-giving, or is it a combination? Every kind of solution has been offered, from the entire abandonment of works and life so far as that is physically possible, to the acceptance of life as it is, but with a new spirit animating and uplifting its movements, in appearance the same as they were, but changed in the spirit behind them, and therefore in their inner significance. The extreme solution, insisted on by the world-shunning ascetic, or the inward-turned, ecstatical, and self-oblivious mystic, is evidently foreign to the purpose of an integral yoga. For if we are to realize the divine in the world, it cannot be done by leaving aside the world action and action itself altogether. At a less high pitch, it was laid down by the religious mind in ancient times that one should keep only such actions as are in their nature part of the seeking, service, or cult of the divine, and such others as are attached to these, or in addition, those that are indispensable to the ordinary setting of life, but done in a religious spirit and according to the injunctions of traditional religion and scripture. This is something that the Gita expressly sets aside. But this is too formalist a rule for the fulfillment of the free spirit in works, and it is besides, professedly, no more than a provisional solution for tiding over the transition from life in the world to a life in the beyond, which still remains the sole ultimate purpose. An integral yoga must lean rather to the Catholic injunction of the Gita that even the liberated soul living in the truth should still do all the works of life, so that the plan of the universal evolution under a secret divine leading may not languish or suffer. But if all works are to be done with the same forms and on the same lines as they are now done in the ignorance, our gain is only inward, and our life is in danger of becoming the dubious and ambiguous formula of an inner light doing the works of an outer twilight, the perfect spirit expressing itself in a mold of imperfection foreign to its own divine nature. If no better can be done for a time, and during a long period of transition something like this does inevitably happen, then so it must remain till things are ready and the spirit within is powerful enough to impose its own forms on the life of the body and the world outside. But this can be accepted only as a transitional stage and not as our soul's ideal or the ultimate goal of the passage. So he insists then that the mere inner illumination that we get from realizing spiritual reality can't leave the vehicle unchanged forever. Perhaps for some period of time, the light sits within us and has a mere influence on mind, life, and body. But at some point, we must go beyond the preparation to the fulfillment, where the spirit conquers the form, where matter reveals the divine consciousness that is pressing into it. That's the transformation that alone will satisfy the integral yogin. Yes, for practical reasons, we have sometimes to simply accept that we have the realization amassed inside, and slowly, slowly it trickles out through the being as it becomes capable of expressing it, as it becomes more plastic, more receptive. So that's one. For the same reason, the ethical solution is insufficient, for an ethical rule merely puts a bit in the mouth of the wild horses of nature and exercises over them a difficult and partial control. But it has no power to transform nature so that she may move in a secure freedom, fulfilling the intuitions that proceed from a divine self-knowledge. Interesting here. Remember, all of this is working within the context of the Rig Veda and the Bhagavad Gita, etc. So Sri Aurobindo is moving into and out of images. The horse, the Ashwa in the Rig Veda, is the symbol of power. And so it is the great vital energy that we have to transform. So we can't simply control it by putting a bit in its mouth and saying, we will force you to behave according to our strictures. That's not transformation. That's regulation. That's a step. And yoga has to use all of the faculties that it can grasp to achieve this kind of yoking to the larger discipline. But finally, we must transform. Simply controlling and guiding is insufficient. That doesn't change the form. At best, Its method is to lay down limits, to coerce the devil, to put the wall of a relative and very doubtful safety around us. This or some similar device of self-protection may be necessary for a time, whether in ordinary life or in yoga. But in yoga, it can only be the mark of a transition. A fundamental transformation and a pure wideness of spiritual life are the aim before us. And if we are to reach it, we must find a deeper solution, a surer supra-ethical dynamic principle. So supra-ethical, beyond ethics. Ethics is a mentally derived system. So again, he is looking for a power of consciousness which really controls the form, the rupa, beyond the realm of mentation. To be spiritual within, ethical in the outside life. This is the ordinary religious solution, but it is a compromise. The spiritualization of both the inward being and the outward life, and not a compromise between life and the spirit, is the goal of which we are the seekers. Nor can the human confusion of values, which obliterates the distinction between spiritual and moral, and even claims that the moral is the only true spiritual element in our nature, be of any use to us. For ethics is a mental control, and the limited erring mind is not and cannot be the free and ever-luminous spirit. It is equally impossible to accept the gospel, which makes life the one aim, takes its elements fundamentally as they are, and only calls in a half-spiritual or pseudo-spiritual light to flush and embellish it. Inadequate, too, is the very frequent attempt at a misalliance between the vital and the spiritual, a mystic experience within, with an aestheticized intellectual and sensuous paganism or exalted hedonism outside, leaning upon it and satisfying itself in the glow of a spiritual sanction. For this, too, is a precarious and never successful compromise, and it is as far from the divine truth and its integrality as the puritanic opposite. Anticipating Ken Wilber by decades. These are all stumbling solutions of the fallible human mind groping for a transaction between the high spiritual summits and the lower pitch of the ordinary mind motives and life motives. Whatever partial truth may be hidden behind them, that truth can only be accepted when it has been raised to the spiritual level, tested in the supreme truth consciousness, and extricated from the soil and error of the ignorance. In sum, it may be safely affirmed that no solution offered can be anything but provisional until a supramental truth consciousness is reached, by which the appearances of things are put in their place and their essence revealed, and that in them which derives straight from the spiritual essence. In the meanwhile, our only safety is to find a guiding law of spiritual experience, or else to liberate a light within that can lead us on the way until that greater direct truth consciousness is reached above us or born within us. So again, we see the pivotal term experience come back in. Just as when we read his Life Divine, he asserted that the greatest knowledge can't simply be figured out philosophically. It's not a ratiocination. It's not a logical reasoning. It has to be a direct perception and experience of the truth beyond polarities, beyond dualities, and only a greater and greater truth can lead you there. It isn't something you get at once, but eventually you must get the touchstone of experience that reveals the identity in things. Until that oneness is grasped in experience, your knowledge is partial, your expression will be limited, and you'll be serving the master of the mind, and not free, moving tranquilly, omnipotently, through the realm of the supramental. So one has to get that. So that guiding law of spiritual experience, or the emergence, and he's speaking here, of the deeper psychic nature coming forward. That psychic nature knows that when it comes from above, because that is its natural being. It came from that. The psyche is the seed of the central being above. The Jivatman, one with the transcendent self, expressing uniquely the power of universality, is the seed of the psyche growing and developing here, evolving in form after form to reunite itself with that. So the immortal soul here is always one with that high self there. It's when the two become one, when one looks into the eyes of the other, as Sri Aurobindo expresses in Savitri, that they fuse into each other, and then you have that signature here in the cosmos where the supreme realm can lean into the lower realm and be the bridge that unites the two. It is the conscious soul, aware here of what it is, aware there of what it is. That is the secret of the union. So he hints at it here. And he says, for all else in us that is only outward, all that is not a spiritual sense or seeing, the constructions, representations, or conclusions of the intellect, the suggestions or instigations of the life force, the positive necessities of physical things, are sometimes half-lights, sometimes false lights, that can at best only serve for a while or serve a little, and for the rest either detain or confuse us. The guiding law of spiritual experience can only come by an opening of human consciousness to the divine consciousness. There must be the power to receive in us the working and command and dynamic presence of the divine Shakti, and surrender ourselves to her control. It is that surrender and that control which bring the guidance. But the surrender is not sure. There is no absolute certitude of the guidance so long as we are besieged by mind formations and life impulses and instigations of ego, which may easily betray us into the hands of a false experience. This danger can only be countered by the opening of a now nine-tenths concealed inmost soul or psychic being that is already there, but not commonly active within us. That is the inner light we must liberate. For the light of this inmost soul is our one sure illumination so long as we walk still amidst the siege of the ignorance, and the truth consciousness has not taken up the entire control of our Godward endeavor. So the psychic being coming forward from behind can cast a beam of light, of true light, and discern, show where the next step is to safely put the foot. And on you go, step after step after step. the working of the divine force in us under the conditions of the transition and the light of the psychic being, turning us always towards a conscious and seeing obedience to that higher impulsion and away from the demands and instigations of the forces of the ignorance. These between them create an ever-progressive inner law of our action, which continues till the spiritual and supramental can be established in our nature. How reminiscent of all that he wrote in the book, The Mother. Aspiration, rejection, surrender. Aspiration opens you to the divine consciousness above. Reject the forms of ignorance. Reject the indolence that gravidly seats you in the old nature. And surrender to the force when it comes. That helps disclose the truth of the soul from within. In the transition, there may well be a period in which we take up all life and action and offer them to the divine for purification, change, and deliverance of the truth within them. Another period in which we draw back and build a spiritual wall around us, admitting through its gates only such activities as consent to undergo the law of the spiritual transformation. A third in which a free and all-embracing action, but with new forms fit for the utter truth of the Spirit, can again be made possible. So these three realms, you might remember that Sri Ramakrishna spoke about that second phase as it's natural when you put a small tree in the ground, a sapling, that you have to put some wire, some mesh, a little fence around it to keep the goats off, etc., while it gets established and grows tall. So for a period of time, it may be necessary to isolate yourself, but you have to come back. Eventually the tree is strong enough, firm enough, that it can stand on its own. So out, in, and back out again more dynamically. These things, however, will be decided by no mental rule, but in the light of the soul within us and by the ordaining force and progressive guidance of the divine power that secretly or overtly first impels, then begins clearly to control and order, and finally takes up the whole burden of the yoga. The divine power, the Chit Shakti, is the divine mother. So she, with her yoga shakti, gives you an impelling push. You'll get started. The more you open to her, then she can begin to seize and control and direct the process, and you're happy for that. You begin to live in felicity, and finally, she takes up the whole of the yoga, and it is your surrender that enables that possibility becoming an actuality. In accordance with the triple character of the sacrifice, we may divide works too into a triple order: the works of knowledge, the works of love, the works of the will in life, and see how this more plastic spiritual rule applies to each province and affects the transition from the lower to the higher nature. In other words, that's where we're going next. So that's a good place to, I think, put our bookmarks for this first evening and this chapter. So let's go to Savitri, Book 4, the Book of Birth and Quest. Canto 2, The Growth of the Flame. I think it's appropriate. A land of mountains and wide sunbeat plains, and giant rivers pacing to vast seas, a field of creation and spiritual hush, silence swallowing life's acts into the deeps, of thought's transcendent climb and heavenward leap, a brooding world of reverie and trance, filled with the mightiest works of God and man, where nature seemed to dream of the divine, and beauty and grace and grandeur had their home, harbored the childhood of the incarnate flame. Over her watched millennial influences, and the deep godheads of a grandiose past looked on her and saw the future's godheads come, as if this magnet drew their powers unseen. Earth's brooding wisdom spoke to her still breast, mounting from mind's last peaks to mate with God's, making Earth's brilliant thoughts a springing board to dive into the cosmic vastnesses. The knowledge of the thinker and the seer saw the unseen and thought the unthinkable, opened the enormous doors of the unknown, rent man's horizons into infinity. A shoreless sweep was lent to the mortal's acts, and art and beauty sprang from the human depths. Nature and soul vied in nobility. Ethics, the human keyed to imitate heaven. The harmony of a rich culture's tones refined the sense and magnified its reach to hear the unheard and glimpse the invisible, and taught the soul to soar beyond things known, inspiring life to greaten and break its bounds, aspiring to the immortal's unseen world. Leaving Earth's safety, daring wings of mind bore her above the trodden fields of thought, crossing the mystic seas of the beyond to live on eagle heights near to the sun. There wisdom sits on her eternal throne. All her life's turns led her to symbol doors, admitting to secret powers that were her kin. Adept of truth, initiate of bliss, a mystic acolyte trained in nature's school, aware of the marvel of created things, she laid the secrecies of her heart's deep muse upon the altar of the wonderful. Her hours were a ritual and a timeless fane. Her acts became gestures of sacrifice. Invested with a rhythm of higher spheres, the word was used as a hieratic means for the release of the imprisoned spirit into communion with its comrade gods. Or it helped to beat out new expressive forms of that which labors in the heart of life, some immemorial soul in men and things, seeker of the unknown and the unborn, carrying a light from the ineffable to rend the veil of the last mysteries. Intense philosophies pointed earth to heaven, or, on foundations broad as cosmic space, upraised the earth mind to superhuman heights. Overpassing lines that please the outward eyes, but hide the sight of that which lives within, sculpture and painting concentrated sense upon an inner vision's motionless verge, revealed a figure of the invisible, unveiled all nature's meaning in a form, or caught into a body, the divine. Namaste. Jai Ma.